Thank you, Greg, and the organizing committee for the invitation to be here to participate in this particular symposium. It's, from my perspective, a salute to Malcolm as we honor his impacts on soil science. And one of the most pleasurable times I had working with Malcolm was on the Handbook of Soil Science, which he was editor-in-chief, did a yeoman's job on that, and I think is pretty well through the second edition at this time. I want to discuss with you a little bit some of my perceptions, at least, of soil architecture. In that regard, I'd like to define it as the physical constitution of solid particles, voids into secondary polyhedral assemblages at multiple scales. And I want to emphasize multiple scales, because if there's anything new, that might be it. Architecture, in many ways, controls the soil processes, dynamics, and functions. I'm reminded of a couple of quotes by Cubiano way back in 38, when he wrote the text Micropodology. A crushed or pulverized soil is related to soil formed like a pile of debris to a demolished building. Neither the structure nor the behavior of soil can be determined from a crushed sample any more than an architecture of a building from a pile of brick. A rather serious indictment of our work on crushed and disturbed samples, but I also understand why this is often necessary. In terms of multiple levels of architecture, I'd like to have you think with me today in terms of systems that go from global to atoms, in terms of from generalized to specific architectures. And of course, decreasing down this ladder, we have higher resolution but lower fields of view. And in that regard, it's helpful sometimes to understand soil structure to be able to scale data knowledge from one level to the next. In a way of background, for perhaps 100 years or more, soil architecture has been used by podologists in multiple ways. Classify soils using diagnostic features, and I'll illustrate a few of those cases today. Separate quality potentials, constraints of soil to land management, indicate soil age and weathering intensity. Infer soil redox and soil hydrology status. These are long-term status. Indicate polygenetic soil history and the impacts of paleoclimate and paleovegetation on that history. Define pathways of hydrologic and chemical transport. And so in essence, soil architecture is really a morphogenetic marker of soil-forming processes. At the global scale, we can actually look at the ordering of soils in the world, conditioned by the soil-forming factors. Climate, vegetation is constrained by landscape relief, soil stability in that landscape or soil age, and geologic parent materials. The high latitudes, we find the cold region gelisols, and in the middle latitudes, illustrated by different shades of green, the alphasols and oleosols, and interspersed between those two belts, we find spodosols and major regions of organic soils, although those two soil conditions don't necessarily follow the latitude aspects. And then, of course, as we move towards the equatorial regions are the oxisols. And in the arid regions, we have major areas in Africa, Australia, Eurasia, and Southwest U.S., aridisols and inceptisols. And if we think of the andisols and think of the regions in the Pacific chain of fire, we would find soils that are developed from pyroclastics and volcanic ash. At the landscape level of architecture, and this is an illustration from work we did in Honduras and Haiti, you often find a rippling effect as you go from upslope to downslope on these high gradient landforms. This rippling effect, of course, or landslides, are due to reverse slumping as the soils lose tosal support upon being wetted and saturated, and reverse slumping occurs. Taking and mapping these soils with digital elevation models, we see a pattern of soils, of course, on the ridgetops would be the most weakly developed soils in terms of endosols and inceptisols. In the valleys are deep organic soils, which are mollisols. And on the steep side slopes, depending upon soil stability, would be moderately deep and deep alfasols. If one superposes over the top of that map the landslides that occurred as a function of Hurricane Mitch a few years ago, a careful analysis indicates that most of these landslides are associated with the moderately deep alfasols. The reason for that is that during or after denuding the vegetation of forests, the tree roots were no longer anchoring these moderately shallow soils to the bedrock. And consequently, these soils became saturated quickly with hurricane events, lost toe slope support, and resulted in reverse mass slumping. On a different kind of a relief, a nearly flat landscape, a vertisol landscape with normal gilgai, where the depressions are filled, micro depressions are filled with water, and the micro highs are ridges that are exposed. If one cuts a trench through those soils and looks at the cross section, we find that where the water was ponded in the surface, that these are the soils that are most deeply leached, dark-colored, and active. Once these dry soil materials become wetted, the swelling pressures exceed the shear strength, and slickenside planes occur, and these planes are illustrated by these zones that are kind of like shingling, one on top of the other. And during shear failure, subsoil materials are thrust along these lateral shear planes up towards the surface, forming the micro ridges. And these are soils then that sort of have a fairly dynamic perspective, even though they occur on nearly level land relief. Another example of topographic expression of architecture is in cold regions, pattern ground, where we have high center polygons that are bordered by ice wedge phenomena. If you cut a cross section through these soils, one finds very quickly that the horizonation is highly contorted, and that due to freeze-thaw events during seasonal warming periods, the surface materials, organic and mineral materials, are churned to subsoils and usually to the depth of permafrost activity. Other kinds of examples of soil architecture at the horizon level have been used as diagnostic properties and features in defining various soil orders of the argillic horizon, which is an accumulation of clay physically translocated from surface horizons with depth. And in this particular case, we uncovered buried surface horizon, paleosol, and that indicates as a horizon marker that these soils are that this used to be the surface of the landform and has subsequently been covered by more recent lusial deposits. Spodosols are photogenic soils, are soils which have diagnostic spodic horizons, which are accumulation of iron metal chelates and complexes, mostly aluminum and iron chelates. And this gives rise to extremely active colloids, which have high phosphorus fixation potentials and are usually in environments of very acid litter at the surface and high leaching potentials. Andosols, on the other hand, have horizonation that imply repeating accumulation of volcanic ash deposits of varying particle size from ash to tephra deposits. And these deposits weather rather rapidly and form andic horizons, which in turn have short-range ordering of clay minerals, allophane and mogulite, high phosphorus, high potassium fixation capacity, silica glass, things of that nature. If we turn our attention to those horizons which tend to accumulate organic matter at the surface in terms of molycopteron, and we have our breadbasket soils through the central plains of Europe, North America, and these are soils that are moderately leached, usually have high base saturation, and again, the horizonation gives us some idea of the physical chemical attributes of such soils. On the other hand, in regions of aridosols with limited leaching and translocation of soluble salts, gypsum, carbonates, we have accumulation of these constituents in the soil, and this is an illustration of a pedogenic petrocalcic horizon that is formed on a high mesa in Arizona through millions of years of translocation of carbonates to this to generate this thick petrocalcic horizon. Of course, oxosols are no stranger to Malcolm as several of these other soils, and represent what I like to think of as a sesquioxide carcass, and with very gradual horizonation, high leaching potentials, limited weatherable minerals present, high phosphorus fixation capacities, often high aluminum exchange, and many other unique properties to these rather strongly developed soils. Moving to yet another level of soil architecture would be aggregates or peds within horizons. And here, pedologists for a long time have defined, described, and utilized the size, shape, and origin of peds to help infer something about the pedogenic properties, namely how they might influence preferential flow of water and solutes, how they might affect oxidation-reduction reactions, tortuosity of porosity, and things of that nature. Granular would certainly be origin, which would be tied to biotic, in part biotic phenomena. So in a further illustration of some of the impact of PED architecture through long-term leaching in an alpha sol in West Texas, the carbonates have pretty well accumulated along PED surfaces in this particular environment. And we can see why that might have happened if we look at an organic anionic dye placed on similar soils and looking at where the dye tracing implicates water movement. Along the macropores, we have superhighways where water movement takes place, relatively less saturated flow on the interior of the PEDs. These two slides illustrate the differences in architect at the hand specimen level of a vertisol. The finely aggregated angular blocky structure of surface horizons with lots of surface area for rooting, nice seed beds, give way in subsoils to zones of slick inside planes, where these zones formed by shrink swell failure have restrictions to movement of water across these interfaces and often are the origin where plant roots grow. Looking at soils which are seasonally saturated, this is a soil in East Texas, a soil which has a fairly well drained upper argillic horizon, and then as we move to the lower argillic horizon, it's seasonally wet along the PED surfaces, and this is an example where these surfaces become sufficiently wet for a long enough period of time, they undergo anaerobic conditions, iron diffuses from the PED surface to the interior and precipitates where oxygen levels are higher on the PED interiors. This kind of a process going cycling over long periods of time can give rise to subsoils with iron pans, sometimes called plinthetic horizons. It was mentioned that Malcolm had done work with saline and alkali soils. This particular hand specimen of a PED called columnar PED structure is indicative of soils which have chemical dispersion of the clays by sodium, and that makes this subsurface zone extremely root and water restrictive. So the effective soil is the surface layer here. And this is simply an example of a plow pan where tillage has taken place over long periods of time at the same depth, and these become root and water restrictive and cause all kinds of havoc if you're trying to irrigate, surface irrigate these soils. At another level is the microscopic level, in which we have evidence from microscopy of soil architecture elements. And this happens to be a soil that has been wet and anaerobic for long periods of time. It is seasonally drains, and when it drains, these macropores become oxidized. Ferrous iron diffuses from PED interior to the macropores, and we end up with an iron Q10 around the macropore looking like this. Another kind of coating that we commonly find in soils that have prismatic structure, for example, are clay coatings, clay films we call them, over the loamy matrix. This is a soil, a frangipane in Ohio. I'll talk more about this in a moment, so I won't take any more time on that. But what I do want to point out that in West Africa, we have soils that are 95-97% sand and silt, but yet these soils under high intensity rainfall events have surface runoff. And the reason they have surface runoff is because they have a very thin, less than a millimeter thick accumulation of the clay in these soils that serve as subsurface bands or as surface seals. And this results in a decrease of infiltration and hydraulic conductivity of several orders of magnitude. This is a cross-section of the Vertisol surface horizon I showed in the previous slide with nice microaggregate structure. And these structural units are about a millimeter in diameter. And notice along the macropores bordering the structural, fairly dense interiors of the structural units are lots of roots, these little brown circular objects. So this is the habitat of the biologic region where most of the activity goes on in these surfaces. However, if these soils are cultivated over long periods of time with disc plowing and moldboard plowing and things of that nature, compaction can take place and these more or less equidimensional macropores become compressed into horizontal porosity and changes the hydraulic conductivity transport of water and solutes are fairly remarkably. This clay film surface that is illustrated here, an example of that under SEM is here, and one can see that this thin clay membrane has remarkably different features in terms of porosity and texture and things of that nature than the matrix interior. And finally, on this is a transmission electron micrograph of the colonies of microorganisms that are within a mesopore. And along the border of that mesopore, some of you may be able to see these rod-shaped micaceous clays that form the interface between the soil matrix and this pore and govern, to some extent, the flux of water, nutrients, diffusion of gases, and so forth from the pore to the matrix and vice versa. This again is an illustration of the very thin shear failure plane on a Vertisol slick inside surface, which the clays have been remarkably reoriented, physically reoriented, relative to the subsoil. This is some work that we did trying to define the relation, the composition of these clay coatings with the root surfaces being out in this region compared to the soil matrix. And in that regard, the coatings in this particular case have remarkably higher amounts of clay content, organic carbon content, extractable aluminum CEC, and things of that nature. So the composition, and this would be dependent on where you did this kind of work, but the composition is remarkably different, and that, I think, with a little injection would indicate that that clay membrane has a remarkable impact on transmission of gases, liquids, solutes across that membrane to the pit interior and vice versa. It also has an impact on uptake of potassium phosphate and nitrate to the root surface as indicated here and measurements of apparent diffusivity with radioactive tracers. This simply indicates that talking about these macro and mesopores, that they comprise only about 5% of the soil volume, but transmit about 99% of the total water flux at near saturated conditions. Of course, the micropores are just the opposite. Most of that transmission occurs along the slick and sides root channels and vertical fissures. I'm going to skip that slide and go to the summary and simply say that soil architecture is a fundamental soil property governing physical, chemical, biological processes, needs a multidisciplinary approach. We need to have observations on in situ properties as well as possible, and it represents a new star in the Milky Way to help solve chemical problems. The concept's not new, but still remains challenging from a soil chemistry database from disturbed to undisturbed samples. And I want to salute in this symposium, Malcolm E. Sumner's many contributions to soil architecture, soil chemistry, and soil science, and silver linings. Malcolm, we wish you great in retirement.